23982, DeVale Chan versus Warden, Chillicothe Correctional Institution. Arguments not to exceed 30 minutes per side. Ms. Barnhart for appellant.
You don't have to unless you care to.
Thanks. May it please the court, my name is Erin Gallagher Barnhart, and I represent petitioner appellate DeVale Chan. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
This appeal is about two witnesses at DeVale Chin's trial, Marvin Washington and Shirley Cox. Everyone agrees that the jury should have heard suppressed evidence about Washington and that it should not have heard improper testimony from Cox. The only issue before this court is whether these errors were sufficiently prejudicial to Chin. First, Chin's juvenile co-defendant, Marvin Washington, was the only witness who testified that Chin had participated in the robberies, kidnapping, and murder for which he was convicted. Indeed, as the state Supreme Court found, Chin's conviction, quote, hinged on Washington's testimony. But Washington had severe credibility problems. The teenager's memory was, quote, far below the norm for his age cohort. A congenital cranial defect caused him to, quote, distort and confuse new information. And he struggled to distinguish between his remembered reality and information from outside sources. His IQ of 48 placed him in the lowest 0.1% of the population. And like many intellectually disabled people, Washington was eager to please and would change his responses to fit the answer he thought a questioner desired.
Can I ask you just a preliminary question? Did the government, it didn't indicate to me, I presume this, but I'm not sure, did they have this in their possession at the time, these psychological reports?
Yes, so the government has never denied possessing the reports. The way they were acquired was a little bit irregular, but they were produced as part of Marvin Washington's amenability hearing under Ohio Juvenile Rule 30, which is the process of determining if a juvenile should be bound over to adult court. And so
that was before this trial, right?
Yes, yes. So anyway, and then there was a hearing, and the same prosecutors as Mr. Chin's case were at that hearing where they discussed this evaluation and determined to keep Mr. Washington in juvenile court.
Okay. Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's no problem. So on top of all those other things that I mentioned, in the suppressed material, Mr. Washington admitted that he was so under the influence of substances the night of the murder that an expert concluded he may have suffered chemically induced amnesia. This is in direct conflict with his trial testimony that he had consumed just a single beer. So the problem is that the jury didn't know any of this.
He testified that he was feeling the effects of the beer.
Correct, yes.
Came out in front of the jury that he had some drinks?
He testified that he had one beer, and then later the prosecutor asked, you know, was he feeling it? And he said yes.
He testified that Mr. Chin or Tony at the time had a Big Mickey or a Big Mouth Mickey, right?
Yes.
But then he said they went to one market, it was closed, they then go to another market, and he said they bought one beer each, is that right?
Well, I'm not sure if he specified the number of beers they purchased, but when he was directly asked how much he had to drink, he said one beer.
Okay.
And never admitted to, you know, blacking out or forgetting any of the evening.
What did he say later, that he blacked out?
He said that in his juvenile court evaluations that were suppressed from the defense counsel and the jury didn't hear. So that was directly impeaching information that had defense counsel had it, they could have, you know, presented his own contrary statement at trial.
Who did he say this to the judge in the juvenile
court? No, there was a number of experts appointed to evaluate him. They did a social history, a psychological assessment, chemical abuse evaluation, that type of thing.
He didn't use that term blacked out, though, if I recall.
I think he said he forgot some of the evening, and the expert said that suggests chemically induced amnesia.
Yeah, it could. I mean, meanwhile, he's driving that car around. He's 15. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is remarkable that a 15-year-old is driving the car without crashing it and, you know, right?
I don't know that it's that remarkable, I think.
You could drink that much and drive like that?
I mean,
I've never tried it, but I imagine it's difficult.
It kind of goes, to some extent, to the functioning of his nervous system, which is basically what IQ measures, that he could, as a 15-year-old, and I don't think I did this when I was 15, I mean, be able to drive around, you know, from one place to another without apparently having any serious mishap.
Yeah, I don't think there was any testimony about, you know, how he was operating the vehicle.
But he drove. I mean, that is unequivocal.
Sure.
And he got from A to B, and the other guy.
Sure. Well, I guess.
Chin drives off with the stolen vehicle.
According to Mr. Washington, yeah. I mean, I guess you're suggesting maybe that what he said about forgetting some of the evening, you know, maybe wasn't credible, but, you know, then there's a question of his reliability and why was he saying one thing, you know, one time and another thing another time. So.
Can I ask you about the standard?
Sure.
So I was grappling with the standard itself. It seems to me like when you break it all down, the question we have to ask is whether any fair-minded jurist could have confidence in this outcome in light of the Brady violation, right? The non-disclosure.
Yeah, I mean, again, since, you know, suppression isn't at issue, it's looking at materiality, and I suppose there's maybe a few ways to go at it if you want to say the state court's decision was unreasonable under AEDPA.
Let me walk you through the way I'm thinking about it. So Brady says reasonable likelihood of a different result.
Yes.
Right?
Probability.
I'm sorry?
I think probability, but.
Reasonable probability. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. At some point, they play with the language in these Supreme Court cases. But then they get down, they have the next tier, which says something about confidence in the outcome. Like, I think it's Weary and Kyle's. Mm-hmm. Then talk about that.
Yeah.
And now we're viewing it through the lens of AEDPA. So Richter asks, could any fair-minded jurist agree with this result? Would fair-minded jurists have disagreement? And so then taking the two together, it's could any fair-minded jurist have confidence in the outcome? Does that seem like a fair way of thinking about it?
Well, I think, don't recall exactly that phrase from Richter.
Richter's beyond the possibility for fair-minded disagreement.
And that's its definition of an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. Yeah, I mean, I think there's that 2254D standard has been characterized a variety of ways. One is if the state court is not applying the applicable standard correctly, and we've argued that's what happened here. They didn't.
Right, but that's just unreasonable application, which is what Harrington's interpreting.
I mean, the court has really been emphatic and summarily reversed our court in particular numerous times for not applying that standard in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that. We're being candid to some extent that in this case, that is really at the heart of the question before us.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I will grant you that there was the non-disclosure of the juvenile records is a serious matter, no question about it. Particularly, you know, it does line up with Weary to some extent where, you know, you kind of had a star witness, a critical witness, prosecution stands or falls. That parallel is here. But then it just comes down to whether, you know, on the particular facts of this case, every fair-minded jurist would be compelled to say that the suppression or the failure to provide these juvenile records undermines confidence in the jury. It's no longer a jury or a verdict worthy of confidence.
Yes, but I think in assessing that standard, it's important to keep in mind what the substantive materiality standard means. So I don't think Richter's gloss takes away the fact that it's not a sufficiency of the evidence test. As Weary said, it's not whether a jury could have still convicted him, but whether we are certain that they would have convicted him.
Well, no, I don't think it's certain he would have, you know, been convicted. I just think it's really the same as the second prong of Strickland. I mean, that and the Kyle standard are, I think there's case law that says they're basically identical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our en banc court has said that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it is helpful to sort of just lay out, I mean, that's our understanding of the rules we're applying here. Could any fair-minded jurist say that that standard was not met in this case?
Yeah.
And I think the challenge that you have in your position is to point specifically to, you know, things in either the trial transcript or the you know, other transcripts or the suppressed stuff that make clear that, hey, nobody who's fair-minded applying the standard could come out the way the Ohio Court of Appeals did.
Mm-hmm. But and as you mentioned, you know, this case has a lot of parallels to Weary, and so I think that, you know, I mean,
can I ask about that? Because, I mean, this case is, I agree with Judge Ketledge. This, what Ohio did, in my mind, is troublesome, to say the least. But Weary had, like, multiple things going on, right? You had a personal grudge by Scott against him. You had that he wanted, quote, to, I think it was, stick the needle in him or get him because he shafted Scott. You had Scott coaching witnesses to lie. None of this was turned over. You had Scott testifying about Hutchinson running to the car, even though he just had knee surgery, and pulling the victim out. So you had, like, different levels, and they related to different witnesses, because you had statements about Brown, you had statements about Hutchinson, and then Scott, and none of this came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the prosecutor made the false claim that Brown never asked for a deal, even though he did.
Mm-hmm.
So you had prosecutors lying, you had prosecutors suppressing evidence, you had a lot going on in that case. And here, where we have a general standard, the Supreme Court in, I think it's Renico v. Lett, has counseled courts to look for a very specific case, Supreme Court case, almost like in the qualified immunity realm, before we find it to be an unreasonable application. So I guess I'm asking, is Weary your best case for that?
I mean, there's of course never going to line up exactly the same number of witnesses, you know, all that kind of thing. And I understand the search for, you know, a controlling authority. At the same time, though, you know, this is a balance between the suppressed evidence and the strength of the evidence, other evidence at trial, and it's, you know, totality, too. And so, you know, I don't want to forget the second claim about Shirley Cox testifying, you know, improperly, that he had, you know, sought legal advice afterwards. That really, you know, puts an extra sort of prejudicial push on there that we, you know, don't have in these other cases. In this,
I think it's fair to say that standing alone, at least in my mind, doesn't do a lot for you.
Mm-hmm.
First claim is much more substantive.
Sure, I think that's fair, and I just want to say it's not. It's the first claim plus, you know, if,
right,
to the extent that we're, you know, I think that really does tip the balance.
You're saying all things being even, let that push it over the edge, basically.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, an important consideration. I mean, I obviously think alone the Brady claim, you know, is enough,
right,
to win, and because, you know, when we look at the strength of the state's evidence, you know, absent Washington, the state does not have a case. I mean, they couldn't even indict the case without him.
Right, but Washington would have testified no matter what. You just would have had more impeachment.
Right.
Sure. I mean, defense counsel talked about, you know, perhaps a motion in limine to see whether he was qualified to testify or not.
What about all the testimony from, did either of your experts, I don't think they ever met him because I know he passed away.
Yes.
Did either of your experts ever meet him?
No.
What about all the evidence from the social worker at the prison about how she thought he was a bumbling idiot when she first met him, but she soon learned he was valedictorian? He wrote his speech on his own. He did all these pretty impressive things. Like, people said, your experts say he can't tell the time, and yet, or people of his IQ can't tell the time, yet their expert who observed him and had him come to meetings all the time, he was always on time, wore a watch. If we don't have a watch, we're not going to be able to tell the time, but as soon as he had one, he could.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's not unusual. Intellectual disability is an inclusion diagnosis, not an exclusion, and we see this all the time in, you know, Atkins cases and its progeny, that intellectually disabled people can graduate high school, they can get married, you know, there's a bunch of stuff.
So graduate as valedictorian?
Well, I think it was like a prison valedictorian.
There's more people in prison. You and I both know that.
Sure, but intellectual disability is against the entire population, and there's a high rate.
I understand that, but I would take issue with everyone in prison being intellectually disabled or even in a juvenile prison.
Sure, but I don't know how many of those people were earning their high school diploma at the same time. But I think that all of this is sort of, you know, not really the heart of the matter, because he had specific limitations that are relevant to the credibility and reliability of his testimony.
But what
that
about
were
the
documented
fact, like, I counted 15 or 16 times in his testimony where he couldn't remember things?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of that stuff did come out. If you go through it, there's a bunch of, he talked, as Judge Keplich said, he talked about the alcohol. Many of the details he did recall, the type of clothing Chin was wearing, the digital clock in the car, the type of car, the dome light, that they had been drinking. And then Ward corroborated some of it. I recognize Ward didn't, he looked at him through the driver's side, the things you say in your brief, but.
Yeah. Well, I think what's important, Judge Thapar, is that the defense didn't have the opportunity to argue that, you know, there's some question about someone's credibility when they are so specific on certain things, a 22 nickel-plated pistol, but yet he can't remember what color jacket Chin was wearing.
That, you know, happens in all kinds of criminal cases, though, right?
Sure, it does, but.
Disabled people to testify.
No, but in this case, the defense had the ability, could have had, the defense did not know that Marvin Washington had these problems. In fact, his trial counsel objected when there was a suggestion that he was mentally disabled, because he was not aware of this. And so instead of being able to point out, you know, it's a little bit funny that this young, impressionable defendant who has been shown to have problems with his memory and to, you know, so, I mean, and you can see it happening. He answers yes, you know, when the defense counsel is asking him if he can read things. The defense counsel says, this is this, right? And he says, yes. And he says, this is this, yes. But then later says, well, I can't read it.
The defense counsel can always bring that out, right?
Right, but the defense counsel,
without this side information,
the defense counsel did not have the documentation that shows that there are reasons why he has these struggles. And the fact that he has struggles in some areas, but not in very important key areas, could have been argued to the jury that maybe there's some coaching going on here, maybe there's even some unintentional, you know, conveying of testimony that they want Marvin Washington to provide. And I say unintentional because, like many intellectually disabled people, Marvin Washington appeared to outwardly present as much more competent than he was. Experts in intellectual ability call this the cloak of competence. There is a stigma attached, obviously, with intellectual disability. And without digging deeper, you know, clinically with expertise, it's very easy to not recognize someone's limitations.
One of the heartaches I have is his expert was with him weekly. I mean, the government's expert, whereas your experts are just looking at the papers and making this conclusion. And I've met, I mean, as Judge Seiler said, I've met a spectrum of people who, many of whom are considered intellectually disabled, that are really sharp people when you meet them, when you talk to them.
Right.
And he seems to fit that bill because, I mean, I'm still struggling with that he, if you accept that he was valedictorian amongst a crowd that maybe isn't the elite of America, mm-hmm. he still wrote his own speech. He showed up to meetings all the time on time. I mean, he was doing things that productive people could do.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really important point, is intellectually disabled people are not intellectually disabled across the board. They have strengths and weaknesses, and that's why the standard is that you look for a certain, you know, number of adaptive deficits. So that's why people can maybe, I question whether he really could have written his speech, considering he couldn't read or write, you know, at the trial. So, you know, all these things could have been tested. But I think the focus on the experts is a little bit misplaced, because it's the underlying information itself that's important. And so, you know, the district court repeated the state court's, you know, conclusion or reasoning that, you know, it wasn't definite that his defense counsel would have called experts to the stand. I think that's the wrong standard here.
We have to have a basis for saying, you know, if Monta, the defense lawyer, had been able to cross Washington with these juvenile records and maybe some expert testimony based on those records, then there's a decent chance this case comes out differently.
And there's a decent chance that at least one juror would have been concerned enough in a case where there was multiple neutral witnesses who gave vastly different physical descriptions of the defendant.
You know, somebody's taller, right?
Yeah, but this isn't a case where I'm looking at this person, I say they're 5'10", and that person's 5'5". I mean, these descriptions were where people were standing next to each other.
Yeah.
The killer and the victim, who's known to be 5'10", were the same height. You know, when he was with Marvin Washington, they were different heights.
What about the defense attorney's testimony? He says, "I'm not a psychologist. I'm reading from his transcript. Mm-hmm. It's on page 13. But I've seen some psychology reports in my time, and I thought he probably would have passed muster anyway." And this is after he's seen the reports.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear, at least to me, what passed muster really means. If it's a competency standard or, you know, qualification to testify. Because of course, I don't think pass muster means every juror would have found him reliable.
No, but right before that, he says, "My perception of Marvin was he was young, uneducated, and not especially bright, but he seemed to understand the situation, what the situation was, and what he was doing there."
Yeah, and I think he's testifying about, you know, when he met Marvin before the trial, that was his impression, and that's without knowing the suppressed information.
I was struck by how lukewarm Monta was about the potential impact of having these records.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a tough one for you.
I think respectfully that's not the standard at all. I mean, I would submit that it would be malpractice for a defense attorney to have this information and not do anything with it.
Here's defense counsel, who I presume is under oath in this proceeding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's asked, would you have made use of this in crossing Washington? And he says something to the effect of, "I suppose so." I did not think it was this ringing.
Let
me just finish. It was not this ringing affirmation that, you know, damn it, I should have had it, and it's an outrage that I didn't have this, and I could have done X, Y, and Z. It was pretty lukewarm. And I'm just saying, if you're a fair-minded jurist in Ohio, and that's what defense counsel, the very person who would make use of this, under oath, not just being uber advocate, mm-hmm. is saying, you know, yeah, it would have been nice. I mean, that would seem to be probative of its potential impact at trial. Who knows better than the guy who tried the case?
Well, I have two responses to that. The first is, I don't think that's really a fair characterization of his testimony. You know, he was, in when asked if he would have hired an expert, his answer was that he said yes, and they asked, "Would you have used him?" He said yes if the expert provided something useful, which is a pretty reasonable response. But before that, he's asked, "Would this information have been helpful?" He says, "Sure," and he's asked it again. He says, "Of course." So, you know, I mean, we don't obviously have a way to judge his inflection or anything like that. I'd also point out, you know, the purpose of this hearing was to examine whether he had been ineffective, and you know, it's not unreasonable to some people to get defensive, and you know, when they're charged with, you know, violating their ethical duties.
Well, why would he be defensive? Because he says at the beginning of the hearing he specifically asked for all the Brady.
Right, but the purpose of the hearing itself was whether it was ineffective for him to not have hired experts about intellectual disability to challenge Washington's testimony. The Brady claims sort of emerged later from that, but beyond all that, the second response is, that's not Brady's standard at all. It's an objective standard of, like, would it have made a difference?
I'm saying it's the standard. I'm saying a fair-minded jurist could think it's probative of the potential impact of these records upon a jury. Somebody who was there who gives, you know, a somewhat lukewarm answer about the potential impact of the records, a state jurist in evaluating that potential impact could take that into account.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I don't think this is, like, you know, crazy.
Especially when we're going back to 1989. I mean, we're looking at this expert, the social worker, were looking at this stuff, and you're trying to determine, okay, considering all of this, could a fair-minded jurist come to this conclusion?
Right.
Right? You're trying to figure out what was going on 30-plus years ago.
Right, but when the jurist explained their reasoning, they did so using unreasonable determinations of fact and by not applying the correct legal standard. I'm not saying that this is, you know, something they need to put
What's
blind.
What's the unreasonable determination of fact?
First of all, I think they mischaracterized Mr. Monta's testimony that he wouldn't have found this helpful. And I think they also, in direct conflict with the factual finding by the Superior State Supreme Court, said that Marvin Washington wasn't that important to the case. And that's just an objectively incorrect statement. It's clearly and convincingly rebutted.
I thought the Supreme Court at one point said he was the key witness.
Absolutely. But the court, the post-conviction court deciding the Brady claim, decided opposite to that, that Marvin Washington wasn't that important. That's an unreasonable factual determination. They couldn't have made the case without Mr. Washington.
Okay. You'll have your rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Brenda Leekla and I represent the warden in this case. As this court has noted, the state did not do everything that they should have done. And you know, the fact that they did not turn over these juvenile records, they probably should have. The fact that...
And you concede they were in your possession.
Well, not in my possession, but based on the timeline, it appears that they should have been in the state's possession because
well, they clearly had them unless
based on when the juvenile hearings, they should have been in
were they produced possession. In the juvenile hearing?
Yes, they were. These were produced, and I believe that the timing is that he was adjudicated in juvenile court prior to Chin's trial, so by extension they should have been in the states. Now I have not seen that, you know, this timestamps on when they had what, but it would appear by timing that they should have had these documents and
What was the most damaging thing to the prosecution that was in those juvenile records? Just the fact that he wasn't well educated and couldn't read and write, or is there something worse? You don't know.
I understand your question, and quite honestly,
you don't know yet.
I don't know what would have been deemed damaging or not. I mean, I don't. If I had been the prosecutor, I would have turned them over. But
you don't have those records now, or you haven't seen them yourself?
I don't recall there being anything other than, you know, the low IQ, and you know, the fact that he claimed he had memory issues at the time. The blackouts that the expert had said that this appears that he had blacked out, but as just Judge Kethledge had, you know, asked, you know, if he's having blackouts, if he's so drunk that he's having blackouts, he's certainly at 15 able to drive a car fairly well and able to remember things that are corroborated by other witnesses. So where the how Mr. Jones was removed from the car and then taken to the back of the car and shot, Ms. Dyer, who is the yard that Mr. Jones ended up collapsing in, witnesses the black Cavalier stop on the side of the road. Somebody gets out of the driver's side. The victim is then pulled out of the passenger side, brought to the rear of the car, and shot. And that testimony from Ms. Dyer matches up with the testimony from Mr. Washington when he is describing. And Mr. Washington and Ms. Dyer, you know, are in two different locations. So that testimony of Mr. Washington is corroborated by another witness. The testimony about Chin going by the name Tony is corroborated by Mr. Ward, who is introduced to Chin as Tony. So we don't have just Washington's testimony in isolation. It is corroborated by other witnesses.
How do you deal with Weary v. Cain? I didn't see you discuss it in your brief, and your friend on the other side relies on it in their brief. So how do you deal with that case?
Your Honor, just as you described, it's vastly different than this case. In Weary, as you pointed out, there is, you know, prosecutors lying, prosecutors, you know, actively coaching, and we don't have any evidence of any of
that. What about Smith v. Cain, the 2012 Supreme Court case, where it's a single witness and there's not a lot of that going on?
I still don't think that you have an issue because we're looking at this through the AEDPA lens. This is not a straight, you know, direct appeal case or anything of the sort. This is an AEDPA case, so you have the double deferential standard that
what
you have to.
What is the standard we should use?
The standard is the AEDPA standard, the unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. This is not contrary to or an unreasonable application of Brady.
What's the Brady standard we should use? Because Weary v. Cain seems to, as your friend on the other side points out, water it down a lot.
The Brady standard, there are, you know, the three requirements. It must be favorable. It must have been suppressed. Prejudice must have ensued. And the prejudice is whether, you know, in the absence he's received a fair trial as understood by a trial resulting in a verdict worthy of confidence. And in
clear, bright line standard for us. So, yeah, go ahead.
Supreme Court's never been great about bright line standards, and that's why we are all employed. But the, you know, in this case, the question is not whether this court on direct review would have done something different.
We totally get it. I think he's asking what's your take on the materiality standard.
Taking the materiality standard is that, you know, this is, you know, this is not material. It is not, while it may have been favorable, you know, even the attorney had said that.
Why isn't it material? I mean, it seems pretty central to the case. Marvin, your friend's clearly right. Without Marvin Washington, this case falls apart. So explain to me why all this evidence that would have helped a defense attorney impeach the most critical witness in this case isn't material.
Well, it's, you know, as the defense attorney even said, he may not have even used it. So, you know,
okay, let's set that aside for, I mean, this guy is the whole case. He's the only one who can, testifies that Chin shot Jones. I mean, there's no one else who can provide that, and it turns out he's got a 45 IQ, and along with that, he's eager to please. I mean, why doesn't that undermine confidence in the verdict?
Well, I would take issue with a couple of points there. The 45 IQ, again, his.
Sitting right in front of me.
Right. No, I understand he's tested with a 45 IQ, but IQ is not determinative, as the court is well aware. In Atkins, there's, you know, three prongs.
Right.
That's not definitively indicative of.
But, you know, again, I mean, at least I'm thinking this in terms of, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've likened this materiality to the second prong of Strickland, where it's fair to say, you know, like what's the likely impact on the outcome of the trial? How would it affect the dynamics of the trial? I mean, this is it. I mean, if the jury thinks that he's not accurate in his recollection, or if they can't believe what he's saying beyond a reasonable doubt, then they probably acquit, right? And so it turns out, you know, I don't know why we get these cases. I don't know why this stuff wasn't produced. Like, why do we have to even deal with this, for crying out loud? But in any event, it doesn't get produced. He's got a 45 IQ. He's eager to please. And now we have to hypothesize. But why? I mean, this is it. This guy is the whole case.
Well, I agree. He is the key witness in the case. To you know, your second point, the eager to please, he's not so eager to please that he doesn't just pick somebody out of the first lineup when there's nobody in the when Chin's not in there. He also does at the lineup, he says he's, you know, Chin is not in there, but then immediately pulls the officers to a side once they are outside of that room.
That could be fun, is eager to please everyone, eager to please Chin, because he doesn't want Chin to think he did it, even though your friend again points out he, in their brief, he could have written down the number, and then he walks out and identifies, so now he's eager to please the cop. Why doesn't that fit exactly what Judge Kethledge is saying?
I don't think that that's that he was eager to please Chin at all. He indicated to the officer and testified that the reason he didn't make the identification in the room was because he was afraid Chin could see him. And
is it wrong that he could have just written down a number?
I don't know if he could have written down the number. I believe he had been conveyed over from the juvenile detention center, so he very well may have been cuffed, and I don't know if that would have been cuffed in front or in back. So he may not have been able to write any number down. That would be facts that in the record, and I really don't know if he would have had that or if they would have given him any writing utensil because of his status as an inmate. So that I can't
answer. I don't know if you know the answer to this, and I'll ask Ms. Barnhart as well. But, I mean, Chin's alibi is he was taking an exam, right? And there's a fellow student who testifies that he was there. Is this exam in the record anywhere?
Not that I'm aware of.
And you can wait till you come up here. I'm just very curious.
I don't know.
It'd be quite interesting if it was, and, you know, it'd be interesting if it wasn't. If that'd be remarkable if it was. But anyway, go ahead.
That I honestly do not know.
Do you remember there were three witnesses who testified he was taking an exam, but I thought two or three of them were like relatives or girlfriends or something like that.
I believe that they were some relation.
But what was the third? Okay.
I honestly don't know. I was, much more focused on the Brady and Ms. Cox testimony.
Well, wouldn't this matter to the confidence in the outcome? I mean, it's like your opponent says, just look at this. You say, just look at this. Don't we have to look at the whole picture?
Wouldn't that include
what Judge Kethledge is talking about?
You do, but I don't know whether the exam was in there, and I don't recall, the relationships between the witnesses who testified. I really do not remember that that fact.
Well, we know that this witness was there. And he was present when the person was killed, right?
Which witness? Mr. Washington? Yes, he was driving the car
Yes, nobody said anything to the contrary. So we know that much.
Right.
And we know he was present when this driver got shot.
Well, Washington was the driver. He pushed Mr. Jones.
Wasn't there a fellow who owned the car or was riding in it?
Yes.
He was the one that was shot.
Yes.
And then we know that he went to this friend's house with somebody he called Tony.
Yes.
So what would any kind of a record at the juvenile detention center show on anything about that?
It wouldn't, Your Honor. It would, and I believe that Mr. Chin wants it to argue that Washington's recollection is not reliable. However, you have corroborating witnesses that, you know, are not related to Washington in any way who, you know, corroborate much of the testimony, being, you know, Mr. Ward, the friend who is introduced to Tony at the house, who then Washington goes back to the house and says, you know, that it Tony just shot somebody. You have Miss Dyer, who testifies that, you know, how Jones was shot. So you have testimony other than Washington's that corroborates Washington's testimony. The Monta's lukewarm response to these reports definitely is probative in this fact or in this case, because you know there's no reasonable probability that outcome would have been different if Monta isn't even sure he was going to would have used it. The fact that he, in his opinion, Washington could have passed mustard, I think is important. Not only that, the fact that Washington was valedictorian, of his, graduating class, whether it's, in prison or not, I mean, he's able to function. Clearly he couldn't have been so intoxicated that he couldn't have operated a vehicle. The other thing with mental retardation or intellectual disability is that, you can feign a low test score. You can't necessarily feign a high test score. So, it was perhaps to his benefit to, test much lower at, the 45 because it was for his court proceeding. And, he certainly had a benefit of not being bound over.
Total speculation, not particularly encouraging. I mean, if you read his transcript, I don't think he had that capacity.
Well, he may not have had the capacity to, test super high, but he also
isn't.
He's
not Jack Nicholson in, Cuckoo's Nest.
No, but he may not necessarily have been quite that low either. I mean, he is able to completely function and tell time and things like that, and get to meetings and things while he's in prison. Not only that, at 15 years old, he's driving a car, not just up the road or, backing out of a parking space, but he's driving it all around, Dayton. That's something certainly my 15-year-old right now, who is not intellectually disabled, would not be, able to do without, wrecking the car. He certainly has much more adaptive functioning than somebody who would typically be in that range, and I think that Monta's lukewarm response to these reports is definitely probative. I think that because of the AEDPA standard here, that this court, really is must find kind of a hyper. This court Chin has to overcome such a high bar to get relief in habeas on this Brady claim because of the AEDPA, deference.
We know. I mean, we're intimately. AEDPA standard, but I mean the state really had all its eggs in this guy's basket. And what about Cox? That testimony. I mean, why isn't that germane, perhaps even to the Brady analysis? I mean, maybe we should probably measure the likelihood of a different outcome against the evidence that was properly admitted, not stuff that was wrongly admitted.
Right?
So we shouldn't consider any of Cox's testimony in considering whether it's material. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't believe that all of her testimony was problematic. If she had testified that she had met Chin as the receptionist of her husband's business and did not say the word law office,
but that's how she met him, right? I mean, there's no part of her testimony that was properly admitted, isn't that true?
I disagree.
Okay, what part was properly admitted?
The testimony about the sketch was properly testified to because defense counsel had made an issue prior to her testimony that this sketch was this composite sketch that Washington helped create was so bad that nobody would ever be able to identify Chin from it. So the fact that she saw Chin in the office and then went home and saw the sketch in the paper and contacted authorities is that, seeing that person, that they only had the name Tony at the time, did not have a last name, was probative and was important testimony for the identification. because defense counsel had put that at issue as the composite sketch was so bad. But had
Are
she...
Are you saying they opened the door to that part of her testimony?
I believe they did. I believe that's why...
Because it's inadmissible testimony, I mean, unless they do something like that.
I believe,
is that fair?
I believe that that is correct. They opened the door and said that the sketch was so bad that, you know, Washington had done that, you know, nobody could identify. And here you have somebody who did identify Chin from the composite. So I don't believe all of her testimony was problematic. What was problematic was the fact that she said she was the receptionist at her husband's law office. Now, you know, as the magistrate judge below said, you know, had she said she was the receptionist at her husband's business and didn't disclose what the business was, her testimony would be completely unobjectionable. And, you know, would the better course have been the trial court should have agreed with defense counsel's in chambers objection that said, hey, she shouldn't say she's in a law office, and the judge said, no, I'm letting that in? I mean, the judge probably should have. But is that determinative? Is that something that caused this jury to convict Chin? No. I mean, what caused this jury to convict Chin was their belief of Washington and the other corroborating witnesses, Ward and Dyer being the two predominant.
Does the state dispute that at the time of the murder, Chin was attending classes at this Cambridge Technical School?
At the moment of the murder, or are you talking about at the time
period? That he was enrolled.
I do not believe that the state ever contested that.
All right, so we can take that as common ground. So he's attending, you know, it's interesting. He's, you know, he's enrolled there. And now we have a classmate and an instructor. So by way of corroborating evidence is what I'm getting at. You've mentioned stuff in favor of the state. I mean, we have this Sandra Taze person and an instructor. I'm not sure where that testimony is. I'd be interested. I haven't seen it, I confess. I mean, that this potentially could be important corroborating evidence for Chin. You know, he says he was taking an exam that night and an instructor testifies.
I mean, but that was before the jury, and the jury was, you know.
Right, but if this was a razor-thin guilty verdict, then, and it turns out, you know, jury didn't know this guy had a 45 IQ, et cetera, you know, maybe they power up some pretty strong expert testimony saying, you know, ability to recall is really impaired at this level of cognitive function. So, I mean, do you have any, I guess I'm soliciting any reassuring words about the alibi defense from your standpoint?
I mean, obviously the jury chose to not believe the alibi defense. So, you know,
if we're looking at the weight of the evidence and it's like, you know, if it's already pretty strong in favor of the state, then these records maybe no big deal. But I'm just saying, you know, is there something that doesn't make the alibi sort of help to even things out? Apart from the fact of the verdict itself?
Well, I think that the corroborating witnesses are what, you know, turns okay. This. I mean, you have Wellborn, the surviving victim, who says...
All he corroborates is two men robbed him.
Well, but he corroborates how the cars were situated, because Washington describes how the cars are situated.
He also says, right, that the other guy... Tony Chin was 5'10", and we know he's 5'5".
I can tell you, Your Honor, I cannot tell somebody's height by looking at him. So,
I get it, but he had a perception. He said he got no good look at him.
Right.
Let me ask you, why isn't your best argument, what time did the murder occur? I thought it occurred at 11:30.
I believe it occurred sometime between 11 and 11:30.
So why wouldn't you make the argument that the alibis are relevant because everyone agrees he was home by 9:30? He took an exam. He wasn't taking an exam at 11:30. Like, he's home at 9:30. Everyone agrees he's home at 9:30. His own mom says he's home at 9:30. She just says he stayed home for the night.
Right. And he very well may have been home at 9:30 and then left.
Right. So why isn't that your argument, that the alibis are relevant? I'm sure that's the argument the prosecutors made.
I believe that is the argument that the prosecutors made, Your Honor, and quite honestly, I forgot that fact.
Okay.
But
your point is that at the end of this, you've got all this corroborating evidence, but their point still is a good one, which is only one person saw him pull the trigger, and that's Washington. So why aren't they entitled to everything they can get their hands on to impeach this guy? And if they are, why shouldn't that affect our confidence?
Well, should they have been entitled to it, I am not disputing they should have received this. I'm not saying
right.
that the state should have, you know, withheld it.
So how is it?
But I'm saying that it doesn't change the outcome because you have the corroborating testimony that Washington, this evidence is tending to show that Washington is not credible. However, you have
three best pieces of corroborating evidence.
I'm sorry?
What are your three best pieces of corroborating evidence?
You have Dyer, who explains how Jones was taken out of the car and brought to the back of the car and then shot and ends up in her front yard, which is how Washington describes that Chin got out of the driver's side, went around to the passenger side, pulled Jones out, took him to the back of the car, and shot him. That Dyer explains that exactly. You also have the surviving victim who says how the cars were situated, and Washington described how the cars were situated, that Washington and Chin both came between the two cars and behind both drivers. That's exactly what the surviving victim describes. And then you have Ward, who testifies that that he is introduced by Washington in this black car to a man named Tony. They talk for about 30 to 45 minutes at the car, and he knows him as Tony. And then Washington returns back to talk to Ward, you know, at this house, and says Tony shot somebody. So you have those are the three witnesses that are key corroborating testimony to what Ward had said, or I'm sorry, what Washington had had testified to. If there are no further questions, we would ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court and deny habeas relief to Mr. Chin.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to start where opposing counsel ended with their three best points and just observe that neither the first or the second witnesses have any identifying testimony about Chin. In fact, Dyer, the witness who saw the shoot.
I think her point is, look, all of this would go to attack Washington, but here's three points that corroborate independent details. And then you could add to it the sketch, which turned out to be pretty accurate. That he testified, interestingly, I read this, I don't think the state brings it up, but in his testimony, he says Chin encouraged him to get an education, and that matches some of your mitigating evidence about Chin himself, and then, and your alibi. And then when he was asked about what Chin said, I shot him in the arm or something like that. This again comes from his testimony, mm-hmm. So I don't recall it exactly. And that's exactly what happened, according to, I think the autopsy said it went through the arm and killed him.
Yeah, the defense's case is not that this murder didn't happen, that Marvin Washington didn't participate in the murder. It's that Chin is not the Tony.
No, I get it, but he identifies him as Tony. He sketches out something that looks like Chin. Ward says that's the guy in the car. I agree with you on what you say in your brief on that identification. Cox, which I think I agree with the prosecution, maybe you should explain to me why I'm wrong. You exclude the law office part. There's nothing prejudicial about someone saying they came into my business office, said they were Tony Chin. I looked at the paper, bam, there was Tony Chin. I mean, all that, at some point, then the question is, could a fair-minded jurist take this and say, that's enough to give me confidence in the outcome in spite of this other impeachment that existed?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Just saying that she said this person looked like the sketch to her isn't prejudicial, but that's the point. The prejudicial part is that he was seeking a lawyer the day after a sketch appeared in the newspaper. That's the part that really, I think, would give anyone pause as to whether this person was really innocent. Now, there are innocent explanations for why he was doing that, but the risk there, I mean...
The risk
that you know someone's looking for an attorney... The prosecutor argued in state court because that is an inference of guilt. It shows culpability.
I get the attorney part and why that's prejudicial. What I'm saying is that the rest of it, I think, is not problematic.
Right. So
and that does corroborate, further bolster what Washington was saying.
Right, but the standard at trial is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And
yeah, but we're not looking at proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We're looking at is there confidence? Would a fair-minded jurist at this point, through the habeas lens, which the Supreme Court constantly reminds this court that you know we're only to this place in the, what did Harrington say, the most rare of cases or whatever they said.
Yeah.
And so maybe this is that case. I'm just saying that this is what I'm looking at and saying, could a fair-minded jurist come to this outcome? And you should add and rebut what I said about the alibi, because I might be wrong, but I thought from the testimony I read that the murder allegedly occurred around 11:30,
right,
and that he was home at 9:30, and so I thought it was girlfriend, but it was mom.
Right, it was mom. And you're right. I mean, the alibi isn't for the moment of the shooting, but the alibi is for a large portion of Marvin Washington's testimony. And the classmate who testified described him wearing different clothes.
Oh, because I'm sorry to interrupt you. Remind me, but Washington said 7 o'clock.
The detective said 6:45, between 6 or 7. I mean,
that's a good point, then.
Substantially earlier.
Did you examine the record?
So I don't know that the exam itself, but there are multiple witnesses besides the instructor and the classmate, and that's at transcript 461 and 482. They also brought on the registrar. They had proof of attendance sheets. So they put a lot of proof in about, I don't think it was disputed that he was, you know, attending classes. Judge Thapar, you talked about, like, you know, is this the case? I mean, Weary was the case. Weary was a habeas case after Richter that found relief, that granted relief. And I think that the evidence in Weary was much more inculpatory than we have here. Other witnesses testified that the victim was seen in a car with Weary. Weary was later seen with the victim's class ring. The witness saw Weary throwing away the victim's cologne.
Remember, Weary was taken on direct review from the Louisiana Supreme Court.
I think it was post-conviction.
I'm looking at it. The 21st Judicial District denied relief. Louisiana Supreme Court denied application for supervisory and or remedial writs.
Right.
The Supreme Court granted cert.
Right. Weary versus Kane. Kane is the warden. It's habeas.
Right. No. But it's not through our habeas process. Right? It didn't go through the lower courts. It went straight from the Louisiana Supreme Court.
Okay.
It sought cert from the Louisiana.
Okay.
And I don't know that did the Supreme Court apply AEDPA? Because I thought they didn't, but I can look as we go.
Well, we can figure that out.
Yeah.
I guess. I'm not trying to cut you off.
No. We can figure it out, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sure. You mentioned the lineup. I mean, there's no testimony that Marvin Washington was cuffed during the lineup. In fact, he testified about marking the paper. There was also testimony that the witnesses' backs were turned, in addition to, you know, what you pointed out, Judge Thapar, about, you know, just having to mark down being the same. You know, I know my time is up. You asked about, you know, as I began, this is all about, you know, is there prejudice? Is it material? You know, do we have confidence? Our brief quotes one of the state courts in the process of this appeal talking about the residual doubt that shows that this really was one of those knife's edge cases where...
Can I interrupt? Just to make this point final. If you look at Justice Alito's dissent in Weary, he points out that by avoiding habeas, they avoided AEDPA in reviewing Weary.
Okay.
So, and you can look at it when you get back and just let us know if I'm wrong, but it's page 1012.
Okay, I apologize.
Can I ask you one question, just be candid with you about something I'm thinking about at least up here, which is... I mean, given some of this corroborating evidence about, you know, how the cars are set up and this woman who witnesses the shooting, mm-hmm. and then the stolen car, it seems very likely the stolen car ends up at Ward's home.
Mm-hmm.
And Ward very likely is introduced to somebody named Tony.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't it extremely likely that whoever Tony was the person who was at least with Washington during the shooting? I mean,
the woman in the driveway was the same as the person.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, I mean, there's the direct evidence, but I don't know if you'd call it circumstantial, almost. But you have a woman who sees the whole criminal episode, and then Washington drives off in that car. I mean, I don't think anybody's really disputing that. And they go, and him and his companion, who was the trigger person, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, the woman who owned the property, she can't identify who that person was, mm-hmm. but that person, you know, the person who is Washington's companion is
sure.
very likely the trigger person, trigger man, I think I can say. And they show up at Ward's place,
mm-hmm.
and Washington introduces that person as Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, now we have multiple witnesses saying the same thing on this point. And so the question really, it's not, I mean, a jury could say, I believe Washington's testimony, or a jury could conclude that Chin is Tony. Either is probably a solid basis to say he pulled the trigger, if you follow me.
I think I follow, but I'd point out that...
tell me where I'm wrong.
The person in the passenger seat didn't stand, so Wellborn has no... Christopher Ward has no testimony about his height. Stacey Dyer says he's the same height as the victim. And so, I mean, there's an inconsistency there. The only thing that links...
11 o'clock at night, but okay.
Yeah, fine. I mean, it was well lit, you know, the street
lights. You agree with Judge Kepledge's premise. Whether that person is Chin. All
right.
Judge Kepledge is saying right. is the shooter sitting next to him when they get to Ward's house. I think
that's what I'm saying.
I think
yeah, probably.
He gets out and the shooter gets in the driver's seat and drives away.
Yeah, I don't know that there's actually testimony about how that switch happened.
Okay, well, we know he made it to the driver's seat, and we know
I'm not sure. Washington said Chin or Tony, you know, drove the car away, but there isn't any testimony about them switching, so...
Okay, all right.
I guess what maybe it nets out is I'm suggesting, in terms of proving that Chin was the trigger man, at least if you're the prosecution,
mm-hmm.
Ward's testimony is arguably as important as Washington's. If the jury really believes Ward, that this guy's Tony...
Yeah, if I was listing the three best pieces, I would have put Ward first. I mean, that's a strong piece. But again, if you look at, you know, other Brady cases where there's way more inculpatory evidence, you know, habeas is still granted. You know, it's still a Brady violation. And one other point that I didn't have a chance to make, but I wanted to remind the court that, you know, Brady applies both to the guilt and the penalty phase. And so Marvin Washington definitely had an incentive to minimize his culpability. Mr. Chin was given the death sentence based on testimony that he was the shooter. I mean, even if, you know, there's not enough to say that, this court, you know, thinks habeas is appropriate for the guilt phase, we still have the penalty phase at issue. This testimony was very damaging, establishing the aggravating circumstances. And so a jury with the case this close could still have enough doubt to not, you know, recommend unanimously death in this case as well, you know, based on doubts about Washington's reliability and credibility.
I mean, as to the guilt phase, what is it that Washington says that Washington is telling him, don't shoot him, don't hurt him?
Yes. Yeah, he says that, and he says, you know, he is the shooter as well. That Tony is the shooter. And in general says this whole thing is orchestrated by Tony. You know, he calls me over. He says, let's do this. Washington is the one who says that at the end of the night, Tony says to him, you know, let's do this again next week or whatever. And the prosecutor, you know, capitalized on that in the penalty phase and closing. So there was a lot of, you know, really powerful prejudicial testimony that came from Washington as well.
Anything else?
No.
Okay, thank you very much for
thank
your
you.
Argument
thank you.
And advocacy. The case will be submitted.